Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I was amazed there were people here on Easter. That's fine. We were going to have an Easter egg hunt in the backyard, but the snow hadn't melted, so we decided to go ahead and have a Dharma talk. Okay. In the last number of Dharma talks I've given, I've started to talk about the six perfections, which are a practice of a bodhisattva. And a bodhisattva, you know, is a Buddhist who really dedicates their life to saving all beings. And I'll say more about that. And so these are the six practices of a bodhisattva. And that's our tradition in Mahayana Buddhism. And I have already talked about two of them. The first was generosity, or a dana, a paramita. And the second one was morality. And that's called sila paramita. And the word paramita just means perfection, or sometimes a virtuous quality. So these are, you know, kind of ideals and things that we can work with. And we certainly want to be generous. We certainly want to have an ethical foundation, etc. And as we'll see today, we certainly want to be have patience. And for various reasons, we don't have patience, for example, then nothing else works. We can be generous, for example. We can be ethical. But the minute something bad goes on and we have no patience, our practice disappears. So here's a little story about patience that actually tells us something about it. And this is a popular story told by Tibetan teachers. I studied with a Tibetan teacher in Los Angeles for 3 years, and they love to tell stories like this. So this is a story about an encounter between a hermit and a herdsman. The hermit was living alone in the mountains. One day a herdsman happened to pass by his cave. Intrigued, the herdsman shouted at the hermit and asked, "What are you doing alone in the middle of nowhere?" The hermit replied, "I am meditating." "What are you meditating on?" asked the herdsman. "On patience," said the hermit. There was a moment of silence. After a while, the herdsman decided to leave. Just as he turned to go, he looked back at the hermit and shouted, "By the way, you go to hell." "What do you mean? You go to hell?" came flying back. The herdsman laughed and reminded the hermit that he was supposed to be practicing patience. You know, so a nice little story. And it really, a simple story really illustrates three things about the practice of patience. And one is, well, oftentimes when we get very impatient or we get angry, it's just something that flares up in situations and just kind of happens, just like this. And then secondly, but not always, patience or impatience often occurs in interactions with other people. Not always. Sometimes if you have a job or you're writing a book or something like this, you certainly need patience to finish it. And years ago, I worked with a very bright guy. And, you know, we worked in the lab, and he would say, "Well, next Monday, I'm going to come in and I'm going to start doing that big project." And he would come in, and about 10 minutes would go by, and pretty soon he would fidget, you know. And the next thing you know, he was gone. And he was very bright, but he never wrote the book and things like this. And then the third thing I'll mention is that real patience really takes a lot of training and effort. And it's not something you just don't decide, "I'm going to be patient." But it takes a lot of practice sitting on a cushion and basically thinking about it. So again, just to repeat, the perfection of patience, it's called shanti paramita, is the most important one. And as you'll see, and if you remember my earlier talks, I've said the same thing about each of the other perfections, because, you know, you need generosity, you need an ethical foundation, but you certainly need patience, because the minute something gets tough, etc., then everything falls apart. Just a little bit about the word suffering in Buddhism. And when I say we need patience, you know, basically something isn't going right. And so we tend to use the word suffering a lot in Buddhism. It's called dukkha, D-U-H-K-H-A. And Now, the word suffering is a little bit too strong. For example, there are other words like suffering, such as misery, grief, sorrow. And my point is going to be that a lot of the words we actually use, like anger, patience, suffering, etc., are part of a whole congeries of a lot of other concepts. And we may not think we're suffering, but if we start thinking in terms of some of these other words, it'll mean more. On the softer side, of course, you have sorrow and grief, etc. On the softer side, we have things like discomfort, worry, restlessness, uneasiness, etc. So there's a whole range of feelings, etc., that can come up and need some work on when we talk about patience, etc. Well, suffering is the first of the Four Noble Truths, and I am just giving some introductory background here. And it's a cornerstone of the Buddha's teaching, but it's often misunderstood. People who are not Buddhists and don't understand it think, well, maybe we're a pretty miserable lot if we're all suffering and we're sitting there in our suffering, etc. And Buddhism is really a practice of negativity, and that's not true at all. So a few words about the role of suffering in Buddhism. First, what is suffering and how does it differ from pain? And this is really an important distinction. So last week or so, you're out walking around and everything's icy. And anyone who's tried to come into the Zen Center through the back alley, etc., we have that kind of ski slope, you know, that it's easy to fall down on. So you fall and it hurts. And you hurt your elbow. That's pain, okay? Now, when you say, oh, why did it happen to me? You know, why didn't somebody go out there and put salt on this thing, etc.? Curse. You know, what kind of neighbors are these who are not taking care of their alleyway, etc.? Why me? Poor me. Well, pain is pain, and suffering is all of this other stuff that you add on. And that's a very important distinction in Buddhism. Because in our practice, you know, we're always, going to experience pain sometime. All kinds of pain. The pain of the death of a loved one, for example, and you get older and creakier and start sitting in chairs, not on cushions, etc. You know, so we're all going to experience pain. And enlightenment doesn't mean pain and hurt go away, etc. Now, what we work on actually is all the other stuff, the old poor me stuff, so that we don't have those kind of reactive responses, etc. And so a lot of our work is getting rid of the curse part distinction. So this is a very important distinction in our practice and one we should keep in mind. Well, human beings experience suffering, particularly if you haven't used the tools to try to lessen your suffering. But there are tools that Buddhism supplies to overcome your suffering. And it's these tools that the Buddha offers in his second, third, and fourth noble truths, if you will. The second truth is basically the reasons for the arising of suffering. It's the three poisons. I'll say a little bit more later. And then the third noble truth says, yes, there is an answer. And the fourth, very simply, is the Eightfold Path, if you will. Experience shows that basically if we don't work directly with our suffering, as we get older, all of this can lead overwhelmingly to despair. People feel that they have an unfulfilled life. They're disappointed with themselves, and on and on. It's quite common. So basically we have the tools to use, and we want to talk a little bit about some of them today. When we start Buddhism, one thing we acknowledge is that, and we should acknowledge, is that we all carry kind of a load of suffering with us. That is this overreaction. We don't have the tools, basically, how to handle that, if we will. But in our practice, we actually make use of our suffering. We embrace it, if you will, and make it a tool, basically, to understand the kind of individuals we are. And in fact, that's one reason why we're born in the human realm. And I wanted to say something about the six realms because they're kind of fun, if you will, if you're not familiar with them. And these are really psychological states, if you will. And there's the hell realm, where you're so consumed with hatred and anger, etc., that you don't have time to awaken, etc. Now, there's the hungry ghost realm. And the hungry ghost is always shown as a great big person, big stomach with a little neck, and they can't get enough food down their throat to satisfy them. Mm-hmm. So they're consumed with greed, right? And then there's the animal realm. And in the animal realm, you're worried about not being eaten and having enough to eat. Some sex would help, etc., things like this. And then the very on the other end, the high end, we have the God realm. And gods are smug, and everything is going great. And so they're not going to worry about awakening. And below them, we have the demigods, etc. And the demigods basically are so jealous. They have a lot, but their house isn't quite as big as that of a god. So they're consumed with jealousy, etc. In the human realm, we just have enough grit, if you will, just enough suffering, if you will, etc., to be kind of a center of our practice. So suffering for a bodhisattva, believe it or not, is like food. It's kind of a spiritual food that really fuels our practice. So suffering is important and crucial for our practice and something that we should try to understand. I use the word bodhisattva, and I wanted to say just something. This is a kind of introductory. There are two major kinds of Buddhism, what we call Hinayana and Mahayana. And the Hinayana ideal is that of the Arhat, and it's spelled various ways, but A-R-H-A-T. And the goal for an Arhat, basically, is personal awakening. In the Mahayana branch, which is our branch, etc., the goal for practice is really saving all beings. And at the end of the talk, and after Paul talks, etc., about what's going on, and we have a little chant, and we say beings are numberless, vowing to free them, and delusions are inexhaustible, vowing to extinguish them. And these are bodhisattva chants, if you will. And so, just a little difference. So, bodhisattva again is the ideal of saving all beings. In reality, of course, there's not much difference between a bodhisattva and an arhat. I think of some of the Southeast Asian insight meditation people as being some of the most kind and caring and loving kind of Buddhist practitioners today. So there's this kind of rhetoric, but in reality, it's not that different. Well, in our society, patience is not highly valued. And so if somebody like me says, learn to be patient, you're going to practice being patient, etc., and you think, well, I don't want to stand in line forever. I don't want to wait to be the last one to be hired, on and on. Impatience, etc. But Shantiparamita is much more than that. It's just not a matter of being patient when you're standing in line. It's really willing. It's a willingness to turn to suffering when it happens and to embrace it and make use of it. To clearly recognize, again, it's food for our spiritual practice. I'll give an example, some examples later, that where you can be impatient because you are standing in line, etc. And this is an opportunity to really examine it and feel it, etc. And feel those reactive emotions. What is patience then? And like the word suffering, the word patience has many nuances, and we always want to kind of break these down. Because you might decide, well, I'm not an impatient person, or I'm a patient person. But what are some of these other nuances, etc.? And other words that really fall in this area are things like tolerance. So tolerance is different than just being patient. Now, what about forbearance, endurance, perseverance, even imperturbability or understanding? So when things get tough, we have to be able to be tolerant, to forbear, to endure, to understand, and all of this is what we mean by being patient. So we're kind of fleshing it out a little bit. In later Mahayana Buddhism, patience or Shantiparamita was really split into three kind of practices. The first had to do with your relationship with other people. Now the second had to do with just hardships in life, like chronic pain, loss of a loved one, something like this. And the third had to do with the the tolerance of the teachings, for the teachings are difficult to understand. And I want to say something about all three of those real quickly. So first is the tolerance in human relations, and it's somewhat sometimes called a gentle forbearance with people who cause us problems. So gentle forbearance. And I think all of us, if we went around the room, could tell stories about somebody who kind of riles them and bothers them, etc. In my own work, I was blessed to be working with two snakes. That's not a kind Buddhist word, but anyway, for many years. And these are people who just were nasty just because they enjoyed it. You know what I mean? And so about every 10 days, I'd walk down the hall to the office of one of them and knock on the door and want to come in. And one out of three times, he'd swear at me and tell me to get out of there. But the other two times, I'd go in and have a good chat with him. And, of course, we never became friends, but it was a real, rather than getting angry at him, you know what I mean, and avoiding him and making things worse, I used it as kind of a focus of practice. Thich Nhat Hanh tells a story about when he was in Vietnam during the Vietnam War, and a young Vietnamese Buddhist priest came to him just angry and all get out because an American soldier had spit on him. Thich Nhat Hanh says, don't be angry at him. You know, he's not bad. He's really been conditioned. In the war, people have said, these are bad people, that we have to do this. And a lot of the American soldiers would look at these, any kind of Vietnamese, and think that they might be, an enemy. So basically, a lot of people have been conditioned to act in certain ways. So in situations like this, we need forbearance, really. You know, we need to understand it a little bit. And the main thing is we have to learn not to act in kind as part of our practice. And so there are little stories like that. One of my practices, and I have a couple, because patience is a good one to work on, and it's called supermarket checkout aisle patience in practice. And I, go up to lunch, and of course there are lots of apartment houses around there, little old people, and I'd get in the line, and there was always some little old person, and I have to be careful, I'm getting to be a little old person, but somebody sitting there talking to the checkout person, and I was impatient. Come on, there are lots of people in line. And then, through the concrete up here, it suddenly dawned on me, of course, that, this may be their main conversation for the day. They live by themselves. Maybe they go to a few places just to engage in conversation with whoever, the coffee server, the checkout worker. So now I make it a practice to kind of look around a little bit. And here's a line. It looks, promising, a couple older people. And I get back in there. And then when they talk, I always say I'm not in a hurry. You know what I mean? And so this is an example. Another practice, and it's a tough one, because remember, a lot of this is reactive, as I mentioned in our story, is if you go down to 36th Street and then you go east to I-35W, you cross the freeway, and if you want to go north, you take a left, and then there's a block you have to drive before you can get on the freeway. And there are a couple lanes there, and the left lane is left turn only before the freeway. All of us pile into the middle lane, and it's just, and then those lights go on, it takes forever to get there. And there's always somebody who drives up the left lane, jumps in front of you, And so when I need practice in the morning, I always go that way when I go to work. So the second aspect is the endurance of hardship. Things like poverty, pain, loss of a job or a partner, disappointment, unfairness. There's a lot of unfairness in life, etc. Maybe you're born into a poor family. You can't pay your college costs. I'm just thinking I have a granddaughter in that situation who's just dying to go to college. We'll see what happens. So keeping in mind the difference between pain and suffering, we work through our pain to be alert to the signs of suffering. And some of the signs of suffering, could be like despair as you get older. Despair, unhappiness. A lot of people feel that they've never fulfilled their potential. You know what I mean? They feel disappointed, etc. Many people adopt some kind of addictive behavior, whether it's drinking or something else, watching too much TV, etc., for that kind of thing, etc. And then in the past, Buddhists used the idea of karma in future lives to actually account for and explain away a lot of these things. And of course, in the present day, that doesn't work in our Western society. But if you saw a poor, miserable person, you would say, "Oh, that person must have been really bad in their previous life. You know, they're getting what they deserve, right? So I'm not going to help them because they, you know, their poverty, etc., and miserableness is a result of their own past behavior." Okay, and so it was easy to discount, you know, the kind of help we kind of do. So today we don't have, at least in the West, and increasingly in the East, those ideas of karma and future lives like that, etc. And rather, our goal, really what pushes us on in the sense is, again, to save all beings, to make social situations better, if you will, etc. And so we have things like Engage Buddhism, which actually started with Thich Nhat Hanh, but actually is a worldwide phenomenon now, where you're trying to make society better and not using excuses for poverty, etc., like karma. Well, the third aspect, and again, I'm talking about aspects of patience, is patience with the teaching, because sometimes they're difficult to understand. And John Dietl Laurie, who was the founder of the Mountains and Rivers branch of Soto Zen, tells a story about when he first started for 3, 4 or more years, that he couldn't figure out what they were talking about. You know what I mean? They talked funny, they talked in koans and things like this. And what really drove him up the wall and made him even madder was the fact he'd look around him and everyone was shaking their head like this, like they understood, and he was the only one basically who didn't understand. So I wanted to say a little bit about some of the reasons why it's difficult to understand the teachings in Buddhism. And I always think it's understanding that really helps, towards, getting rid of, for example, this feeling that, well, maybe I'm dumb or I don't understand, etc. So two reasons. And one reason is in Mahayana Buddhism, interpretation and everything we can talk about really works on three levels. And so you have to understand when you encounter something, what level is it being given to you? So there's something like just the literal level. So somebody says, be tolerant. Or some of you are in the Chukai class and are learning to work with the precepts. And there's things like don't kill. So the literal level would be don't kill. Be tolerant, regardless of whatever. Stand in that line. And there's stories about Buddhist monks with brooms sweeping a path in front of them so no little critter would get stepped on, things like this. The second level is the bodhisattva level. And this is the level of compassion. Is it always the best thing to do to be tolerant regardless of what? To be patient regardless of what? Can we afford to tolerate anything and everything, such as murder, rape, war, racism, and sexism, things like this? So the answer must be no. And so our practice is not passive indifference, if you will, but rather actually trying to save all beings and taking the action where we will. The third and perhaps most confusing level of the three levels is the Buddha level. So we have the literal level, the bodhisattva level, and the Buddha level. And at the end, somebody, after the talk is over, somebody will say, well, there were so many levels and so many things I can't remember anything. Suzuki Roshi always says, what I'm saying isn't important, forget it, etc. We'll move on to the scones and the tea. Okay, so just feel relaxed with whatever I'm saying. But in the Buddha level, basically we know in at least Mahayana Buddhism that there are two kinds of reality, and one is conventional reality, and that is that there are lakes and desks and books and things like this, And then the other reality is the reality of emptiness. And you know, my concept of it, which is a little different, is that there's this whole mass of energy, and that we split it up using concepts and words. And different cultures split it up in different ways. Okay, so their realities are slightly different. But it doesn't mean in this ultimate sense that there are chairs and rivers and things like this. And of course, the differences are important. You know, if you decided food is too expensive, I'm going to live on rocks, you know, you're not going to get very far. If you decide I'm going to walk across Lake Calhoun in the middle of the summer, you're not going to get very far, etc. So there are things about that energy out there that are important, and some of our concepts are used to name them. However, in emptiness, we don't use words, we don't use concepts, because that brings us right back into the conventional world. Okay, and so what do they do in Buddhism? In many Mahayana sutras, they use myth, parable, magic, etc. I think of the parable of the raft. You can think of the idea of a chair or a wall or a house or a lake, etc., as an illusion. And this is the way Buddhists see it. It's an illusion, just like a magician would make an elephant appear. Now, you know there's no real elephant there, but you see the elephant, right? And it's the same thing with the use of magic. For example, in one of our classes, we read the Vimalakirti Sutra, and there's all kinds of magic. You know, there's magic kingdoms and, you know, all kinds of things coming on. And this is a way to allude indirectly, basically, to this world of emptiness. And so it's very hard to understand and hard to get your head around. And then the same thing in much of our Zen story is actually a myth. And there's a wonderful but academic book, and so you've got to watch those academic books by John McCrae called Seeing Through Zen. He's got a number of McCrae's rules or principles for studying Chinese Zen. He died about a year ago. He must have been quite a card. But his first rule or principle is that Chinese Zen is largely myth, and therefore it's more important. So you can begin to see why some of this is hard to understand. One of the big differences between Hinayana and Mahayana Buddhism is that the early sutras, etc., actually take place in historical reality, and that's important to understand. So the Buddha walks around, he meets real people. People don't recognize the Buddha sometimes when he walks around. So this is historical reality. And what happens in the Mahayana period, they realize that we have to get out of historical reality, and we have to locate our stories in myth, because that speaks more deeply to us as individuals, just like Grimm's fairy tales, etc. You know, they're timeless and placeless stories, even though they seem to have an origin someplace. So no Bodhidharma in reality, no Hui Neng, the sixth patriarch, etc., though there may have been historical people like that. But they're telling us something. They're telling us stories in a mythic way, which is more important than just an historical teaching. Okay? Of course, all of that means that it's very hard to understand. You know, it's very difficult to understand. You have all these levels, etc. You have myth and magic and parable, etc. So be patient with the teachings. And I found that through a process of absorption, you seem to get some kind of understanding. Okay, I'm going to close with some words about anger. Now, anger is the antithesis to patience, and it's a huge problem on the spiritual path. Because if you're trying to sit, you're trying to be patient, etc., you know, all of this can fly away with a flash of anger. And of the three poisons, and there are three poisons, you know, anger, these are the extreme words, anger, greed, and ignorance. And of those three poisons that produce suffering, etc., anger is the most severe and the most difficult to overcome. So where does anger come from? And here are three stories about anger. The first has to do with, it's an ancient story way back at the time of the Buddha, about a man who goes out in the river to fish. and he anchors his boat, and the water in the river is flowing along, and he's just fishing away, and he looks up, and around the corner of the bend, way up there, another boat comes along. And he keeps his eye on it and fishes, and pretty soon he sees it looks like it's coming right at his boat. And as it gets closer and closer, he's pretty sure it's going to hit my boat. You know what I mean? And he starts yelling. He says, "You idiot!" You know what I mean? He's really angry. And then as the boat kind of crashes into his, he sees that there's no one in it. And his anger is gone like that. And it was a boat that came unmoored, you know, and just floated down the river, you know, just like that. Now, here's another story about anger. And this is a wonderful little, well, you are at the grand opening of a new shopping mall on the edge of town. You've been driving around looking for a parking space for 10 minutes. At last, right in front of you, a car pulls out of a spot. You hit your turn signal and wait as the car backs out. Suddenly, from the other direction comes a Jeep that pulls into the space. Not only that, but when you honk, the driver gets out, smirks, and gives you the finger. Are you angry? Now change the scene ever so slightly. Instead of a brass Jeep driver, a cow walks into the space from the other direction. It settles down in the middle of it. When you honk, she looks up and says, "Moo," and doesn't budge. Does that make you angry? And this comes from a wonderful little book called The Cow in the Parking Lot. A Zen Approach to Anger. I think there's one other I have to read in just a minute. But, one other story. And then you can look at it later. One more comes out of here. But this is called Heaven and Hell. And again, it's a traditional story. And it says, a big, tough samurai once went to see a little monk. In a voice accustomed to meeting with obedience, the samurai said, "Monk, teach me about heaven and hell." The monk looked up at this mighty warrior and replied in a voice of utter contempt, "Teach you about heaven and hell? I couldn't teach you about anything. You're filthy. You stink. Your sword is rusty. You're a disgrace to the samurai class. Get out of my sight." The samurai was speechless with rage. His muscles bulged. His face got red. He swung his sword high above his head, preparing to slay the monk. "That is hell," the monk said softly. The samurai froze. Suddenly he was overwhelmed by the compassion of this tiny, defenseless man who had just risked death to give this teaching. As he slowly lowered his sword, he was filled with gratitude and wonder. "That is heaven," the monk said softly. Okay. So where does anger come from? Now here's a little saying by the Buddha from the Dhammapada. The Dhammapada is a wonderful collection, this short verses from the Buddha's teaching. And a lot of people have it near their bed, and at night they read it. It says, this is the very first opening verse. He says, "We are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we make the world." So anger comes from our thoughts. And let me read that again, because we should all have that with us. We are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we make the world. So why does anger arise? And, three reasons. One is it seems to be a normal human emotion. So the goal is not to eliminate anger, but really to place it in our expression of it in a different context, to understand it differently. And I think of the story of the Dalai Lama, who when somebody asked him about his thoughts on people making money out of the Dharma, teaching large amounts of money and things like this, and as he went on, ran it on and on, his face got red, etc., he was mad, right? It seems to be, and particularly if we think of anger, not just in terms of anger, but we unpack it with other words, like discomfort, dislike, I'm irked. All of those are different shades of anger, right? And I don't think I get angry. When I think of anger, I think of, kind of out of control. But I know I get irked. There are lots of other things, that I express, etc. Second, we have been conditioned to use anger. And if you just look at the movies and the TV programs and things like this, you see people solving problems by shooting, and things like this. And third, anger seems to be addictive. You feel good. You know, when that car cuts you off in the road, there's something about raising your fist, and things like this. So there are a lot of reasons why anger arises. So the question is, how do we manage anger? And just a few hints. And it's a huge topic in Buddhism with many books. I mean, there are lots and lots of books, including The Cow in the Parking Lot, etc., about how to manage anger, just because it is so destructive. And one way I found in my own sitting is actually to create a space between the rise of anger, etc., and my viewing of it. And I don't know if you do this in your practice, but you think of yourself as the observer. You know, you're an observer who actually looks at what thoughts come up. And by creating that thought, that space between the observer and what comes up, it gives you a chance to think about it a little bit and wait and put some space in it before you actually react, etc. And so that's a good practice with, and that's actually part of our, it's not chikantaza, it's sikantaza. You sit there, which is our mature practice, you sit there and watch. I call it unfocused awareness of whatever arises. But earlier in your practice, you have a focused awareness and you look at what arises. You know, is it jealousy, for example? What's going on? Is it anger? Is it boredom? Whatever. So create a space, etc. It also helps to remember that an insult itself is harmless. You know, remember, it's I giving it meaning, right? And I haven't heard this a long time, but when I was a kid, there was that old saying that sticks and stones can hurt my bones, but words will never hurt me. I think that's the way it goes, something like that. And I remember, I look back, and we all have things in our life. You look back and go, geez, I did that, And I was walking along the Greenway a few years ago, and there were lots of bikes going by, and there's a little walking path, and the bikes were using part of the walking path, etc. And I was kind of scrunched up against the fence, so I decided, well, I'm going to show them. So I got to the edge of the walking path and made myself look big like a bird that fluffs up, and so the bikes would have to miss me. And then the bike comes along, and there's an elderly Japanese man pedaling along, and he looked at me, and he just raised one eyebrow. It was just the cleverest thing, I mean, right away, through my heart, he wasn't chiding me or anything like that. He was just letting me know that was inappropriate action. I always remember that, and to this day, I'm convinced that it was Manjushri, the Bodhisattva, of wisdom who was on that bicycle, etc. Another way is to work with what's called pattern imperatives, etc. And this isn't a typical Zen practice, but something that I learned from my Tibetan teacher. He raises questions like, what pushes your button? What gets you angry? Or what makes you happy? And things like this. So what pushes your button, etc.? And that button, so to speak, is called an imperative, etc. And the purpose of this meditation is to identify the imperative that drives certain patterns of behavior. And I'm going to go through steps real quickly, etc. First you choose a pattern of habitual behavior, some kind of reaction that's angry, etc. Or at least it's, angry is such a big word, it's like suffering is too big. But something that kind of upsets you. And this causes some difficulty because, it makes you feel uncomfortable. And then you push on the behavior with attention as you sit in meditation, etc. You imagine behaving differently. And then you watch what kind of reactions and emotions actually come up. You observe the arising and operating of reactions. So we have lots of reactive emotions. Somebody comes and does something, and right away, and that's part of your personality. Part of your personality is how you react, etc., in different kinds of situations, etc. And by observing these reactions, you can recognize what the imperative is, that I'm being put down, I'm not being valued, whatever it is. And this is what you have to get at, is just not that person's action, but the imperative behind it that basically, makes you angry or makes you dislike it. And you can actually go on, and there are other ways that you can work with these pattern imperatives. You can actually break them down more finely. But you can also figure out to what extent patterns consume your life. To what extent is your habitual behavior, you know, the way you break into a conversation, the way you talk with your kids or your parents or whatever, you know, a lot of these really are the result of these kind of reactive patterns, etc. And then when you're done with that, you can work on how you push other people's buttons. You know, the things you do. And this summer I've been married 49 years. And people say, how do you do it? Oh, it was just luck, believe me. But one thing I learned is shut my mouth, and not react. People come back from work, and it's been a hard time, and they just are venting off. And they look at me and, you know, you're wearing that same old sloppy shirt for the fourth day. Well, you know, so I've learned not to react, you know, but yeah, I like that sloppy shirt, you know. But because when you have those kinds of fights, it's up to you carry it around for days. And if you're in a relationship, you know how that works. I mean, people get mad at each other. Here's another little story about carrying anger around. This is a famous story. Two monks, Tanzan and Akito, were traveling down a muddy road. A heavy rain was falling. Coming around a bend, they met a lovely girl in a silk kimono and obi, a little sash, who was unable to cross the road. "Come on, girl," said Tanzan at once. Lifting her in his arms, he carried her over the mud. For 2 hours, Tanzan and Akito continued walking in silence, as is the monks' practice when outside their temple. When the temple was in sight, Akito could no longer restrain himself. "We monks don't go near females," he told Tanzan. "I can't believe you actually touched a woman." "No, actually embraced her." Tanzan says, "I put her down 2 hours ago. Are you still carrying her?" So that's a, you know, an interesting story. Okay, now read a book. A topic I'm just going to mention because we're just about at the end of our time is when we think of anger and we think of the poisons, we think of them as individual things, things that we possess. But think of institutional anger, anger that actually becomes a way of reacting by a political group like our government, etc. Think of war, for example, automatic threats, you know, things like this, punishment, harming as a national policy, etc. So if we're going to save all beings, how do we counter that kind of anger? You know what I mean? And so it's a broader part of our activities. So finally, let me mention an American folk saying that I think fits in here. It goes, never wrestle with a hog. The hog gets dirty, you get dirty, but the hog enjoys it. And the point is, of course, you know, that like my partner in where I worked, etc., that he enjoyed being miserable and you know, really, you know, making people feel uncomfortable. And if I reacted instead, you know, he enjoyed it, but I didn't. Okay? And so this is a good little story. Never wrestle with a hog. The hog gets dirty, you get dirty, but the hog enjoys it. And so that other people who's cutting you off in a car may just enjoy it, etc. So anyway, I think I've talked enough, and maybe I've convinced you that the most important of the six paramitas is Shanti Paramita for all of these reasons. And the next Dharma talk I give is on the perfection of energy or effort, which is certainly the most important paramita, for who can awaken without effort? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any questions or comments quickly? We just have a few minutes. Yep.
I had one of those town parking lot moments a few years back. I like one of the theater occasionally, watching blockbusters. I can't remember the movie, but I usually sit in the back, and the film will start, and they come out with these things, turn off your cell phone, blah, blah, blah. Everyone's pretty good about it. I watched a movie, and way in the front, someone had turned their cell phone off, their iPad, whatever it was. So this thing was on the whole movie. And it wasn't affecting the movie, but I could see this little light out of the corner of my eye. And this whole movie, I'm like, turn that thing off, turn that off, you know. And I was watching the movie, and it just irritated me the whole time. And the lights, at the end, the movie's over, the lights come up. That wasn't a phone, it was a control panel on an electric wheelchair.
We all have stories. Wonderful story, thank you, Leo. You know, it reminds me of the story of the guy walking down the street and he's just kind of looking down and somebody bumps into him. You know, and he looks up and he's really angry, the same kind of story. And he sees the blind guy with his cane. You know, any other stories? Well, okay. Thank you very much.